You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lachlan Balfour tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Monday Wire for Rahina, Monday the 6th of May. It's also New Zealand Sign Language Week. It's one of our official languages, so go and learn it. Learn NZSL.nz is a great resource for this. Anyway, I'm Lachlan, your host, filling in for Jemima today, and I'm joined by new producer, Izzy. Izzy, how are you going today?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
Yeah, how's the first wire been so far?
So far, so good, honestly. Yeah.
Well, some people say I'm a great mentor.
And clearly, yeah. So much to learn.
Yes, and we have got a cracker of a wire for your first one too. On the show today, James Shaw joins us for our weekly chat, this week discussing the tender of land in Taranaki for coal and gas exploration, as well as the Welfare Working Group's report. Michael from Southern Cross is here to talk about all the news over in the Pacific. That'll be about 20 past. Izzy speaks with Peter Malcolm from Closing the Gap about rheumatic fever and how it's linked to inequality in Aotearoa. And finally, News Director Lillian speaks with Malu Malo Fuiava from Belong Aotearoa about their workshops on Te Tiriti. Hia ha ofakaro. If you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātu mai, send through a text to 5395, or wai mai, you can give us a call on 309 3879. Might even get to talk to Izzy. How do you feel about answering the phones?
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, good. Mm, that's great. Yeah, some people don't like doing it. I think it's great having a yarn. Tuku pātu mai. Tuku a tupoti ki te pai te hau. Don't forget to vote on our Twitter poll on @95BFM News. What is our poll?
Our poll today is whether you're disappointed with the government's response to its working groups.
Yeah, so that's kind of the tax working group
and the welfare
one.
Yep.
Both their responses have not been...
Yeah, a bit of a double whammy there.
So. Not been great, according to some. But, you know, get voted on that on @95BFM News on Twitter. But, you know, for now, I reckon let's get into The Wire.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
It certainly is that time. I was up bright and early to chat with the Green Party today. Speaking with co-leader James Shaw, we had a discussion about the land in Taranaki that has been put up for tender for coal and gas exploration, and also the Welfare Working Group's report. Here is James.
So Ngāti Runui are disappointed some of their land will be offered up for onshore mining by the government. What has the Green Party done to try and stop this?
Well, there's a few things. We managed to limit the coverage. So if you look at the block offer 2017, the release area was over 500,000 square kilometres. This time it's only 2,000 square kilometres. We've got sort of new conditions that require permit holders explicitly to engage with iwi about any activities that could occur in areas that are important to them. The area that's covered specifically does not include places like Parihaka Pā, Mount Taranaki, the Pauakai, Pukaiti, Kaitaki Ranges. You know, these are areas of importance to Māori. There's also areas that are being investigated by the local councils there and local iwi regarding possible wahi tapu sites. Those are also off limits. So, you know, we've been pretty clear about this. We would prefer not to be doing onshore gas exploration. We tried to include that last year when we got the offshore exploration ban, but we couldn't get that over the line. So I think what we have done is managed to restrict it severely and make sure that iwi interests are being taken care of to the maximum extent possible.
Did you feel there has been enough consultation with iwi in the process?
Well, there was consultation with iwi and hapu in the area, but, you know, clearly the local iwi don't feel that was adequate. I would just say that we need to keep making best efforts.
So, yeah, obviously for the Green Party, the ideal situation would be no onshore mining. How, looking to the future, are you going to try and stop more of this happening?
Well, one of the things that we did get when we did the offshore oil and gas exploration ban last year was a agreement to review the onshore within the next few years. So the reasoning at the time for allowing onshore exploration to continue was that there is actually some question about gas reserves and our ability to transition to fully renewable in the time that we've got gas available. And there just wasn't good advice or good science available to us to be able to make that clear. So I'm hoping that we'll have much better science and advice when that review rolls around, so that we could say, yeah, look, we can actually make a call on it.
And this is something, I suppose, the Green Party, this is what you stand against. You're fundamentally an environmental party, really. Are you worried that allowing this sort of thing to happen could get a bit of a backlash from your members?
Yes, always. But ultimately, you know, when you're part of a government and you're, you know, only a support party in that government, then you have to accept that you win some and you lose some, you know, and in fact, no party, even the major party, you know, the Labour Party, doesn't get everything it wants, as illustrated recently with the capital gains tax decision. And that's just a function of coalition governments.
Well, I suppose you've had quite a few losses recently. Are you worried that these are kind of mounting to a point that the members are going to be really quite angry?
No, I'm not. Obviously I travel around the country and I talk to our members and our voters quite a lot. And for the most part, people, you know, are really delighted that we're in government and that we're also getting significant gains. And you have to look at this in the round, you know, that there is a sort of a balance between... you know, all of those things, all of those, you know, if you want to describe them as wins and losses, and generally the people who I speak to feel like we're doing a good job, that for the most part we're doing what we, you know, that we're kind of getting the wins, so to speak, and yeah, people are disappointed by some of those decisions, but it's better to be in government than not. Because it means that we're able to do things that you just could never do from opposition.
I suppose, I mean, you say it is better being in government than not, but at what point do you say, well, we're compromising our principles so much that is it really better than we're in government?
Well, I mean, that's a really tough call to make because, you know, there are decisions occurring every single week here that we're involved in. And so I guess I would have to look at our confidence in supply agreement and to say if we felt that was being compromised, if we weren't able to deliver on our confidence in supply agreement, then you'd have to question, you know, that was a sort of almost a contract that was drawn up that said, you know, in return for supporting the government on confidence and supply, these are the areas that we're going to see some progress on. And actually, when you look at the confidence and supply agreement, we're doing really well. So, and in fact, we're over-delivering against some of those measures. So I think on balance, we're a long, long way away from any question about whether or not it would be worth staying in government or not. I just think, you know, the losses, as you call them, get quite a lot of publicity. The wins don't get quite so much. So we have to spend quite a lot of our time when we're talking to members and supporters, kind of letting them know what's going on. But, you know, like I said, on a weekly basis, you know, we're getting traction. So, yeah.
And moving on, a long-awaited working group into the welfare system has called for a systemic overhaul of the welfare system. This is sort of hardly what we got in the response from the government. What are your thoughts on, I suppose, the report itself and the government's response to it?
Yeah, I mean, we were really pleased with the report, and it sort of largely echoes what we had been saying before the election about the state that things have fallen into over the course of the last 30 years or so. So it kind of confirmed our suspicions, if you like, and I think gave government a pretty clear steer about what we needed to do with that. Release on Friday, you know, there was a bit of publicity over the weekend saying only three of the recommendations were being accepted. That's true at the moment, but there is a, you know, there will be kind of more to come in the future. Now, partially that's because when we got the report, budget bids had already closed in the budget process, and so we have been kind of fairly late in the budget process trying to jig things around to be able to at least get started on those recommendations. And the three recommendations that we are acting on immediately are the ones that were at the top of our list when we were campaigning in the last election. So that, I think, is really good news, that we're actually finally able to deliver on things that were at the top of our priority list, in particular this piece around sanctions applying to women who didn't name the father of their child, would, you know, losing their benefit or part of their benefit. And that's frankly outrageous. Mm. So it's good that we've finally got rid of
but
that.
I suppose that is a fairly easy change to make. It's sort of something most people can say, yes, this is unfair. How do you feel about sanctions still remaining within the welfare system, though? Is there any place for them?
Well, this was, you know, what the report said is that for the most part, there was very little justification or evidence that supported those sanctions, and very little reason to continue them, because the evidence suggests that they actually just don't work, and all they do is make people poorer. Mm. So, you know, those are things that we need to look at for the future.
Is this something you're going to be agitating for?
You bet.
And further to this, they recommended that the benefit be raised 47%, so sort of catch up with the cost of living. The government is not going to do this, and doesn't look like they're going to be doing it in the future. Are you disappointed by this?
Well, I mean, we're going to be advocating for rises in next year's budget and beyond, because people are living below the poverty line. And you know, I mean, the report was very clear about that, and that's frankly unacceptable. So we're going to keep pushing pretty hard on that.
And these, I suppose, these initial three recommendations the government's implementing and possible further ones, how are these actually going to help those on the benefit if it's just not enough to live on, let alone raise a child on?
Well, all of them have a benefit. And, you know, when you combine them with some of the other things that we've done in government, such as the mini budget straight after the election, at the end of 2017, where we put an additional $500 million into the system, and further rises in last year's, or, you know, further support through things like the winter energy payments and those kinds of things. You know, everything that we are doing is making life better for people who are in those circumstances. Now, you know, I support all of those changes. We do want to go further. The report gives us a really clear steer about how to do that, and we'll be advocating for that in the future.
I suppose overall, are you disappointed with the government's response? Would you like to see more of an endorsement of some other recommendations? Do you think they've been a bit cautious?
I would like us to move further, faster. I always have. But I've got to say that, you know, I was listening to another radio report this morning talking about a new opinion survey saying, you know, people feel that we should be paying teachers more, and that we should spend more on health and education. You know, we've also got this welfare working group report that suggests, you know, very significant increases are necessary and important. And at the same time, people are saying, oh, well, we don't want a capital gains tax. So, you know, it's kind of well and good to say, yes, we support increased spending in these areas that are important to us. But the revenue, you know, people also need to get on board with the idea that that's going to mean increasing revenue.
But I suppose, I mean, there is a surplus at the moment in the sort of the books that were just released the other week. What's the point in having these surpluses if the government's not going to spend it in these vital areas?
Well, the size of the surpluses doesn't even begin to cover what the welfare working or, you know, that some of the changes that have been mooted for health or education. And they've got to happen every single year. And, of course, you know, your surplus kind of fluctuates year after year. So
you think it's better to sit on it than spend it?
No, I don't. I think that it's inefficient to have massive surpluses, particularly, as I have said before, when you've got people living in cars and garages. Mm. But my point is that the overall size of the changes that are being wanted do call for an increase in revenue above and beyond any kind of surplus that we're able to run.
And I suppose you did say people were saying they didn't really want capital gains tax. Do you think that's true? Do you think the majority of the public was against it? Or this was just Labor and New Zealand First trying to justify not implementing one?
No, there were a number of different polls that were conducted. There was only one. There were different ways of doing capital gains tax. There was one model which involved putting a capital gains tax on investment properties only, and that was the unanimous recommendation of the tax working group, but then offsetting that with income tax cuts at the bottom end of the spectrum. So, people with that kind of lower income tax band would be a bit lighter for people. And that was a revenue neutral model. And people looked at that and said, that did get a majority of support in polling. And that would have helped to correct the unfairness of the existing system and helped to make it more progressive, but it wouldn't have raised any more revenue for the government to be able to put towards things like the benefit changes or increased spending on health or education. So at some point, if New Zealanders really want the outcomes that they say that they want, they're going to have to talk about what that means in terms of increasing revenue.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
That certainly was James Shaw. We're just going to go into a quick ad break and we'll be right back with Southern Cross.
Good morning. Okay, the new Cater Station jingle. What have you got, creative? Give me gold.
The Cater Station.
Yep.
Yum.
Yep.
So, yep.
Anything else?
Yeah. When your team needs filling up, they can't be satisfied. Their appetites need servicing, so open wide.
Could we outsource this one?
Great idea.
Cater Station are holding a competition to find their new jingle. Do you have what it takes? If you do, you could be walking away with a cool $1,000 cash. Find out more. Go to 95bfm.com or text JINGLE to 5395.
It's your Kiwaha o te wiki, your saying of the week. This week, me arawa ake, Nick Minute.
Bro, have you been watching Game of Thrones?
Nah, bro. I started watching it and me arawa ake, it started buffering.
Bro, not the slow internet ones.
Me arawa ake, Nick Minute.
Your Kiwaha o te wiki, brought to you by Ngātauira Māori, the University of Auckland's Māori Students Association.
I know where you were last night.
Craig, it's not...
Am I not deep enough? I can be emotional. I can break the fourth wall.
Wink.
I know we don't have the same history together.
But I love both of you.
No! Make a choice. Me or theatre.
Live for drama? Take some stage direction from our resident theatre expert. What's on and what's good on the Auckland stage? 9 a.m. every Friday on Breakfast. Stage direction with Johanna Cosgrove. Brought to you by the Vic Devonport.
Now it's time for the Southern Cross.
Yes, Southern Cross is back today, and we're talking to Pacific Media Watch contributing editor Michael Andrew. Michael, how are you going?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good, yeah. Nice day, weather's good.
It's autumn, the fall.
It is, yeah. It's getting a bit cold, But apart from that, I'm good. Yes, so our first topic, the Papua New Guinea government is in a bit of turmoil. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is probably the biggest story of the last week. So the government's been in a pretty dire situation for some time, but it's had a mass exodus of its MPs from its coalition government. So there were about two dozen MPs that left the coalition last week and joined the opposition, and then a handful more left yesterday and over the weekend, and they're planning a vote of no confidence later in the week to remove the Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, who they're not happy with. They think they're going to have the numbers because more and more MPs are defecting to vote effectively vote him out. We'll watch the space.
Why aren't they happy with him?
He's been accused of kind of government mismanagement. That's probably the biggest thing. So it's a number of things, really. But the provinces in Papua New Guinea haven't been getting much attention, and that's under his watch. So a lot of the governors and the MPs from those regions, and that's where the majority of Papua New Guinea's population lives. That's the really important areas up in the highlands, and they're not getting much attention or love, and that's created a lot of dissent and dissatisfaction in the government. So that's a reason, the main reason why these MPs have decided to go away.
Right. So following the vote of no confidence, will that mean the opposition comes into power, or will there be another election?
It depends. It depends on what he decides to do. So it will be one or the other. But it's just an indication that they're not happy with him and they don't think he's fit to be in power. So they may call another election, or it may just be that he steps aside and lets another take his place.
And I guess just finally on this, is this something that's sort of unprecedented in their history, or does this kind of thing happen a lot?
Well, he's been in there since 2011, so it's a relatively long tenure. So there have been murmurings of dissatisfaction throughout his time in office, but never anything like this, as far as I'm aware. But prior to that, I'm not too sure what the state of the government has been.
Well, I look forward to keeping up with that one.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely.
And next up, so some research from Columbia Journalism.
Columbia Journalism Review. So this is back to Christchurch and the Christchurch attack. So their research came out which compared the performance of the New Zealand media covering the Christchurch attacks compared with the international media, and it used a bunch of kind of guidelines, like, for instance, not using the shooter's name, publishing his material or any of his ideology, and they found that the New Zealand media did so much better than the international media, especially the tabloids in the UK, who just went crazy trying to get as much scandal as possible, publishing his manifesto and talking about his ideology. So the New Zealand media did really well, and they found that there's this idea called prevention journalism, solution journalism, which is about not the traditional journalism news values of who, what, where, and when. It's about, okay, what's the problem here? How can we write in a way that remedies it and prevents it from happening again? And they found that New Zealand journalists were actually applying this methodology to their work, not in a way of just getting the best stories, but, okay, how do we really get to the root cause of this and expose it for what it is and prevent it from ever happening again? So the stories that they produced indicated this intention. So it was really good.
And, why did they provide any reasons for maybe why New Zealand was doing it better?
They didn't provide any reasons, but one can assume that, I mean, it's much closer to home, we're much connected, and I think the general societal compassion we all felt compelled journalists to go beyond their normal training or their normal what they had been indoctrinated with, perhaps, and just step up and approach things differently. I mean, it's a personal thing for every Kiwi, so even Kiwi journalists were compelled to report and write in a way that really got to grips with the situation.
Has New Zealand journalism had a general trend of writing in this manner when reporting on perhaps international events?
No, I don't believe so. This is unprecedented. It's thrown the whole thing on its head, to be honest. Like, prior to the attacks, the New Zealand media had a dire record of reporting on minorities, especially Muslims. Mm. There was total misrepresentation and the misconception of ideas, but it's just flipped everything around, and it's really made journalists reflect on how they've reported and how they can do things better, because the result of bad reporting and misrepresenting can be hatred and can be resentment, and that's the exact thing that you want to prevent. That's the exact thing that you don't want it to fester.
I mean, going along the same line, World Press Freedom Day was last week.
Yes.
There was a student journalist discussion and debates at the University of the South Pacific. You want to talk about this and maybe give us a bit of a recap of what else went on?
For sure. So World Press Freedom Day was last Friday, and it's not that much of a big deal in New Zealand. I mean, we have a very free press relative to the world. We're number 7 on the Reporters Without Borders Free Press Index. So it's kind of taken for granted here, but in the Pacific it's a pretty big deal, and they make a point of celebrating it wherever they can. And in Fiji, for instance, the University of the South Pacific, who's one of our partner institutions with the PMC, they held a big ceremony and discussions and debate with student journalists and basically discussing the importance of free media in Fiji and the Pacific. And the theme was how free media matters during times of elections and democracy. And they all gave their opinions and thoughts and discussions on how to best counter the belittling they receive when they're trying to report on elections from politicians and whatnot, because that happens a lot. They don't have ready access to information. They're not taken that seriously. It's not they're not revered at all in their jobs to collect information and be the eyes and the ears of the public and hold politicians to account. So this is exactly what they were trying to address in their ceremony and in their discussions, how they can counter the challenges they face during elections and how it's essential for the democracy of these countries.
Wow. And yeah, I suppose politicians probably don't hold them in very high regard, but does the public also share this view?
It depends, really. Because in certain parts of the Pacific, the leaders are very revered. That's just a kind of traditional mentality. It's like your elected leader is someone whom you respect and you don't question their judgment. It's the job of a journalist to question their judgment and to hold them accountable. And it can appear impudent to the public. So there have been cases of a lot of resentment against journalists, but hopefully that's changing because as time goes by and democracies become a bit more well-oiled, they might understand the role of journalists have in creating a clear picture of, all right, who's our leader? What's he doing? Is he the right person for the job? And that's basically what they need to be doing.
Wow. Hopefully. Yes,
hopefully.
We shall see. So what is happening over the next week?
Okay, so the Philippine elections are coming up on the next Monday, I believe it is, or 13th of May. So that's quite a significant one because it's Rodrigo Duterte, who's the very controversial and very brutal leader of the Philippines, who's been responsible for a so-called war on drugs, in which many people have been killed and incarcerated. And of course, he's not very kind to journalists either. So it remains to be seen what happens there. Also, the Australian election is coming up next week on the 18th. And that will shed some light on the great mystery that is Australian politics, because no one really knows what's going on there. There's been quite a bit of turbulence over the past few years. And also, we'll be looking into the president of Indonesia, the newly elected president of Indonesia, Joko Widodo, who basically pledged to be fairer to West Papua a few years ago and allow more journalists, more foreign journalists, into accurately report. He hasn't done that, and there's been a lot of criticism as to why he's neglected his promise and why journalists still aren't allowed to be let into West Papua to report on human rights abuses, which he said he would do. So that's a massive problem, and that really needs to be talked about more.
Great. Well, I look forward to it.
Cool.
Thanks so much, Michael.
No worries, my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And you can read all the Pacific Media Centre updates at asiapacificreport.nz. Let's play the outro, and then we'll head into Roaches by the Sykes before Izzy brings us her first ever Wire interview. I'm excited.
That was the Southern Cross.
As I'm lying in my grave, I realize I just can't forget the Beatles and the Roaches telling threats from my sweater.
Following a press release from Closing the Gap, I spoke with Peter Campbell about rheumatic fever rates in New Zealand. As a developed country, critics have said it is shocking that we continue to have an increasing rate of this preventable disease. However, the issue is not only medical. Coined the canary in the coal mine for inequality, we talked about how this disease could be significantly reduced by targeting inequality in New Zealand. I started by asking Peter what rheumatic fever is.
It is a fever which in fact infects a number of the body organs, and in particular can do serious damage to the heart.
Right, so clearly quite a serious issue.
Very.
How is inequality linked to this disease?
It's quite clear that many of the factors that produce the disease are poor standards of living. Cold, drafty houses in particular, lack of good food. In other words, lack of good living environments. Very clear that that is one of the aspects of inequality. Inequality, of course, is the gap between the rich and the poor. It's not just the gap. When you look at the overall economy of any country, in fact, unless there are mechanisms in place that ensure that the wealthy don't take too much of the benefits of society, then the poor suffer.
So would you suggest that New Zealand has a massive inequality issue?
It's interesting. I'm just writing another press release right now because information came out from Massey University, I think last week, about the fact that inequality is growing faster in New Zealand than most OECD countries. Professor Schumacher. Apparently they've been doing some work on this for some time, but I haven't got down through the detail of the whole thing, but the overriding statement that he makes is that income inequality in New Zealand has been growing faster than most OECD countries.
If a medical approach isn't sufficient for this disease, what needs to be done?
We need to lift the standards of living of the poor in New Zealand.
Is the government's response to the welfare report sufficient to target this issue?
I'd be really interested to see the budget that's coming out in about a month's time. Grant Robertson has talked a lot about well-being of society, and well-being, of course, is very much associated with standards of living. I'd be really interested to see what the government is prepared to come up with towards that end. I've got to say I'm a little pessimistic about it, because in fact changes to the tax system were one of the ways in which you could do something serious about inequality, and it's not just income inequality, it's wealth inequality as well. And the fact that they have, I think, clearly stated that they're not going to change the tax scales and they're not going to introduce a capital gains tax, together with the so-called budget responsibility rules, which has limited the total tax take in New Zealand to around 30% of GDP. I'm not sure where they're going to find the money from to undertake some redistribution that will help the poor in this country.
If the government's response regarding the tax system hasn't been sufficient, would you say that the best solution would lie in a tax policy solution or in something else?
Well, I'm not sure what they're going to come up with. The fact that they seem to have ruled out a tax policy change would suggest that they've got some other ideas, and I'll be very interested to see what they turn out to be.
Do you have any further comments on this issue?
It is a serious issue for New Zealand. We're supposed to be a developed country. We're supposed to have high standards of living. And I think it's obscene that we have a significant number of people whose standards of living are such that third world diseases can exist in this country.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Ko te Wire, tēnei marunga BFM. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. We will be right back after a quick break.
Hey Mum, how do I keep on the cutting edge of great new music?
When a DJ loves a record very much, they do a special kind of cuddle.
Never mind, I've sorted it out.
The answer to your problems. Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a lovingly curated collection of what's new, what's hot, and what's good in music.
The May playlist is up now, featuring Aldous Harding, Fat White Family, Amuki, Black Mountain, and so much more.
95BFM's monthly Spotify playlist. Stay au fait.
How do you bend light? How small is nano? Explore these questions and more at Mighty Small Mighty Bright, a thought-provoking new exhibition at MOTAT. Mighty Small Mighty Bright, today's science, tomorrow's technology. Opens Friday, May 17th. Go to motat.org.nz.
Où est Penelope? Parlez-vous les croissants? Non? Voulez-vous 69 tons de lait de bande? Penelope noire. Je t'aime. Penelope noire. Où est Penelope? Elle est 13 et 16 lundi. BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Last Friday, the government's welfare working group released their recommendations on reforming New Zealand's welfare system. They called for systemic change and heavy investment in the sector. The government agreed to implement three of the group's over 40 recommendations, with many saying this was not good enough. I spoke with Jenny Cartwright from Child Poverty Action Group, first asking her what her thoughts on the report were.
The report is really good. The report shows a really thorough and considered approach to what the inadequacies are in the welfare system and where they've stemmed from.
How overdue is a report like this?
There's been this kind of exercise in practice before. I think the last time there was an expert advisory group on welfare, it was in 2012. So it's not unusual for this kind of a process to occur when there is a new government. But we also noted that the last time round, the report from the expert advisory group had some really substantial recommendations and very few of them were followed through on. So we were really hoping for some transformational change out of this report. The government has signalled that child poverty is their absolute aim, reducing child poverty, sorry, is their absolute aim. And so this exercise was really, really important to be able to find strategies to really put some real good policy work behind that.
And what do you feel were the most, or not the most important, but maybe some of the bigger changes that were suggested by the report?
Well, for example, the report suggested that benefits should be increased by between 12 and 47%. So that's main benefits, and that's looking at the structure of, you know, all of the different benefits combined. So increasing benefits substantially is something that really, really needs to happen, and sooner rather than later, because we have so many families that really just can't get by on the kind of incomes that they've got.
And moving on to the government's response to the report, they've said they're going to immediately implement three of the recommendations. Can you talk about what they are going to be implementing and maybe...
They're not immediate, unfortunately. So we're able to have immediate responses to the report, but the policies that they have announced and the expenditure that they have announced as part of a pre-budget release won't actually come into effect until April 2020. So the three main announcements that the government responded to the WEAG report with last week were that they would have 263 new frontline staff to focus on helping more people into meaningful and sustainable work, which is terrific and really, really overdue. And it is something that the government has signalled that they have been working towards anyway. They also said that they will scrap the discriminatory sanction that cut income for women and the children who can't name the child's father on their government application, which is a really punitive sanction, and it cuts benefits by up to $28 per week. And we have been asking for that sanction to be removed for a really long time, so we're really, really pleased about that. But that won't come into effect until April 2020 either. And the government signalled when they came into caucus that this was one of the first changes that they wanted to make, and it will take until nearly 3 years since they were in government for that to actually happen. So while it's remarkable that it is going through finally, it is taking far too long. The other thing is the abatement thresholds for those on benefits who work will be lifted in line with minimum wage increases. So they'll be lifted in line, and so by 2023, that will be $25 more for job seeker support recipients and $30 more for sole parent support recipients. But CPAG has asked for that to be $150 per earning adult in the household, and currently that response by 2023 takes the earned income threshold to $105 for job seeker support recipients and $130 for sole parent support recipients.
And do you feel they've sort of maybe chosen not the easiest recommendations, but the ones that are possibly most palatable to the general public to implement first?
Well, I suppose it comes down to really at this stage what's in the budget already and what they had to work with. So what we have seen is that what, you know, has really been confirmed is that there's not a lot of wiggle room in this budget for welfare, which we're really disappointed by. So this $268 million expenditure over 4 years is quite different to the $5.2 billion per year that the WEAG group has suggested is needed to really reform the welfare system.
And how much hope do you have of the government implementing further changes?
Well, they have announced that there will be a 3 to 5 year plan. So what we really want to see is that plan as soon as possible and the incremental stages at which these recommendations that the WEAG group has laid out will be implemented. So we want to see exactly when they will come in and what the plan is long term to support people's incomes and to make sure that they don't further fall behind. So we are looking to next budget. Clearly, we're looking actually to this budget because we don't believe that we've heard everything. So we are looking still to this budget for some more responses. We are hopeful still that there will be more substantial responses to this report out of the budget. But I also think that there's going to be a lot more action on this, and there clearly has to be. Otherwise, we won't make the transformational change in people's lives that is so desperately needed.
And you spoke earlier about the report's recommendation for the benefit to be increased by up to 47%. Do you think this is likely, and I suppose how important is it that something like this does happen?
Well, clearly there's two stages at which there needs to be increases. There needs to be increases in working for families as well as there needs to be increases in benefits. So CPAC has asked for the discriminatory and work tax credit to be joined up to the first child family tax credit so that every family with children who receives their main income from a benefit will be $72 better off per week. And the WEAR group report has actually addressed that by increasing their recommendation is to increase the family tax credit by $72, I think, around about there, per week. So we were really, really hoping to see changes to working for families as well as changes to the core benefits. Our core benefits, particularly for sole parents in New Zealand, mean that people are living very, very far below the poverty lines that the government has set out as part of the Child Poverty Reduction Act.
Is this going to be something that is very difficult to get the government to do, to actually increase them?
I would hope not. The thing is that benefits haven't really gone up substantially since they were cut in 1991. So with the mother of all budgets came in 1991, some benefits were cut by up to 25%. And that was a huge, huge step backwards for families who are living below poverty lines. And it's meant that they have spent years trying really, really hard to claw their way back up again with very little to be able to do so. So what we're hoping for is that the government actually realises those real, real damages done by those policies that were enacted in the past and can actually respond to those by looking at benefits, increasing them yearly in line with wages, but really substantially increasing them as a start because they are far too inadequate for people to live on. We're hopeful that that is part of the plan and part of the more immediate plan.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Belong Aotearoa, formerly known as Auckland Regional Migrant Services, has been running for over 15 years. It's an organisation that supports migrants and former refugees in their arrival to New Zealand. The vision is an inclusive, connected New Zealand, and they work towards this through a range of different support services such as workshops, community outreach programs and settlement support to help people get the skills they need to find work or connections to other people. As part of these workshops, Belong Aotearoa works together with Treaty Peoples, an organisation looking to ensure both new and old settlers in Aotearoa are educated about Te Tiriti. News director Lillian Hanley spoke with Malu Malo Fuava, the fundraising and marcoms manager for Belong Aotearoa, about these workshops. She started by asking why the ARMS organisation changed their name.
So part of it was around, I think, 2017, we conducted a study around looking to see what the needs of our community were, just to make sure that the services that we were providing were relevant. And what we found was that a lot of the issues and barriers that migrants and former refugees or just any newcomers to the country are facing are the same barriers that they faced 10 years ago. So it called on us to have a look at what we were doing and what we needed to change. And so our change of strategy is around systems change. So looking at the systems in which
that these barriers existed, and so we acknowledge that the journey to settlement and integration is not a linear one. It's fraught with different barriers along the way that impact people's lives. And so these are things like access to affordable housing, underemployment, trauma, marginalization, social isolation, and these are prevalent and exist across many systems in New Zealand, so not just education and employment, but also health and other areas, such as justice. And so, but the underlying issue across all these different systems was racism and discrimination. So we knew that we needed to change our strategy. And I guess one of the things that most people, newcomers to this, to New Zealand, are looking for is that sense of belonging. So we wanted our new name to reflect that.
Do you guys receive a lot of funding? Because this seems to, you know, in terms of being an organisation that can reach out to the entire country, is yeah. there sort of government funding behind this?
No.
Wow.
So most of our funding is through philanthropic trusts and through grants mainly. So we do apply to government in terms of Auckland Council and local boards, but we don't have any, guaranteed central government funding.
Hmm. Okay, well, so to the treaty workshops. Now, the Te Tiriti o Waitangi is a controversial topic to a lot of people in New Zealand. Many people like to say that it's something that we should just forget about, get over. It happened in the past. Why is it important that we have these conversations with newcomers to Aotearoa?
I guess it's just an acknowledgement that of New Zealand's history, and that the Treaty of Waitangi itself is a founding document, and some also see it as the first immigration document. So it relates to newcomers today in terms of understanding the history of New Zealand, but also where we are today as a result of that.
And how do you go about doing that? Is it just the treaty workshops, or is there sort of other things involved with it?
So for the treaty workshops, we do work, so the treaty people, Te Tangata Tiriti, they deliver the content, but we also run marae visits, and we have run noho marae in the past, in which people, we invite a whole bunch of newcomers through our community connections and just through our normal channels of promotion. And they come to a marae and they experience, I guess, multicultural in different ways. So they'll experience a pōwhiri, a hongi, they will get taught a haka, some waiata, and they'll have a different range of cultural aspects of that we as Kiwis and New Zealanders have seen and kind of grown up with. So for a lot of newcomers that come here, they find it really valuable in understanding Kiwi ways.
Have you found it to be that a lot of people were quite receptive to kind of receiving that knowledge?
Yep, so a lot of our feedback is quite positive, and a few people have noted that there are a lot of similarities between their own culture and Māori culture, and even just the history that they learn, they've also seen similarities, especially where people come from countries that have been colonised before, that they can see, they find a greater connection between, I guess, the Indigenous people of New Zealand and also themselves.
Something that I've seen, at least working in the media or studying that sort of stuff, that you do, there's a tendency to pit perhaps the Indigenous people against migrants or also vice versa. Have you found that?
I think, yes, I guess that is present. And I think with Christchurch, a lot of those barriers kind of went down because there were similarities that they could see between, I guess, the treatment of Māori and also the treatment of Muslims and the wider ethnic community. So I think that there is a lot of that, I guess the argument around resources, but it's a different one. It's a difficult one to navigate because you do see both sides of the argument.
And it's a complex conversation, right? But those are the conversations we have to have.
That was The Wire.
That certainly was The Wire for another week. But before we leave, let's discuss our poll. So you want to remind everyone what our poll was?
So poll for today was how satisfied you guys are with the government's response to the working groups. So that's both the capital gains and the welfare report.
And the results, have you got them up? No, I've got them up. 93% say yes, so they are disappointed.
Yes, indeed.
I'd be in that camp too, I think.
Yeah, I would actually put myself there as well.
I don't know. It's sort of like you've got these working groups, the resources that go into them, the time, they come back, they give you the recommendations, and then you don't really implement anything much from them.
Exactly. So I mean, I suppose there's always the argument, oh, it's first steps, but it's pretty far cry from overhaul of the welfare system, for one, and just to have no CGT whatsoever in Jacinda's term.
I sort of wonder, I don't know, how much of it is New Zealand First hampering things and how much of it's Labour just unwilling to be as radical as maybe they first promised they would
be. That they campaigned on, exactly.
Well, yeah. Disappointing nonetheless. Hopefully, I don't know. Hopefully,
I mean, we'll just have to see
something
what happens.
But so far, disappointed. Anyway, thank you so much, Izzy. Your first Wire, great job.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, yeah, and we look forward to it next week.
Absolutely.
Things will only get better and better exponentially, I'm sure. I'm Lachlan. Thank you to everyone who spoke to us today. Up next is the 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.